Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Philip Morris. I'll call Philip Morris, CEO of Proctor's Theatre, and Christine Sheehan, Director of Education Programs for Proctor's. The education department at Proctor's was launched as a mandate by Philip Morris soon after his arrival in 2002. Proctor's has educational programming and summer camps in all aspects of the performing arts, ranging from Broadway dance to jazz bands, and they have embedded educators in three area high schools. Proctor supports the Schenectady High School Retrievers, the only high school team in the world working on technology for the Mars rover. In addition, Proctor's offers theater talks following each Broadway show's Thursday matinee through Capitol Repertory Theater. They also tour schools throughout the region. We'll talk with Philip Morris and Christine Sheehan about all that and much more. But first, welcome, Philip and Christine.
Hey, thank you, Alan.
Good morning. Welcome. Thank you.
Good to see my old friends back with us today. We have tremendous admiration for what you do and what you have done at Proctor's. It's an extraordinary story that really is instructive to everybody who wants to know how you can do the impossible. And Philip, I have to say, you've done the impossible. You've taken that theater and made it the center of Schenectady, and you've marshaled all your resources, and you have fought the good fight. The last time you were here, you were talking to us about the dangers to local theaters that might come from the establishment of casinos and their ability to bring in big stars and their insistence that nobody around could have the same big stars. How did that all turn out?
Turned out well. The fair game agreements are being signed now, and in all three regions, the casinos are friends of ours.
And so how did that turn out? I mean, what did you have to do to make that happen?
Well, that was the big effort to get the legislature and the governor to agree that there was a potential risk, that the risk was large, and to open the door for a negotiation with each of the applicants. And our negotiations through this collective group of 11 theaters called Fair Game successfully negotiated agreements that were acceptable to all of us.
And did it ever get nasty?
No. Nope, it didn't. Though there were three or four.
When you were here the last time, you had blood in your eye.
There were three or four who refused to sign agreements with us. So that got nasty. But then they weren't selected.
They weren't selected, right, to be the casinos that got the licenses.
Right. All four of the licensees were terrific.
So, Philip Morris, when you had to marshal the forces of, you know, money, you got a lot from Schenectady, right? You got a lot from the state, didn't you?
For
the theater.
No.
One way or another.
No, very, very little from the state. It was a local effort with Metroplex, a local effort with...
What was Metroplex again?
Schenectady Development Authority. Metroplex is the only regional development authority in the state of New York, and it gets half of a percent of sales tax in order to spend on development efforts.
Yeah.
And we were one of them. $10 million, nine and a half. $10 million came from individuals. $10 million came from traditional debt, and $10 million came from historic tax credits.
Yes.
So that's how our $40 million project came together.
Now that was $40 million, but now you've got your eye on something else, something bigger, right?
No, it's not so much something bigger. You know what we have our eye on is having relevance and meaning. And the education program is the bottom line of that. It is how we establish relevance. Our program has grown from doing shows in the theater for kids that came by bus to being in 150 school buildings throughout the region. It's probably a $4 million program a year, something like that. And it's an enormous effort on our part to connect with young people. And after we worked together in the region and looked at the creative economy and saw how many jobs there were in the creative economy, 30,000, between designers and media and performance and things like Adirondack Scenic, who build all the rides for Disney, and Savvy Sound that installs sound systems around the world, including casinos. We went, oh my God, this is really a workforce development effort. This is not just about, which we thought was pretty important, getting to kids who otherwise don't have a window of opportunity to this side of their life, this part of their brain. But it's also really about employment, because there are 30,000 jobs. As we interviewed the employers, the big ones, private sector, They went, the biggest problem we have is recruitment and attraction and retention.
But I don't understand what the 30,000 jobs are. Could you explain that a little bit more?
So in the study, the way the study worked, they broke down the employment numbers from the federal government, and they took them out of industries and put them into what kind of work. So instead of it being manufacturing and education or whatever, it came down to, is that an arts job? Is that a creative job? What kind of work it is? And so the creative employment became the people who are working either for creative businesses or who are doing creative work for traditional businesses. And that number came to just under 30,000, which makes it the fifth largest employment type. Can't call it a sector. It's type in the capital region. And the capital region ends up being the second highest percentage of such employment in the country for an MSA of approximately a million, million and
MSA
a quarter.
MSA is...
Metropolitan Statistical Area of a million, million and a quarter.
Does that include the Berkshires?
No, it doesn't, because the Berkshires did a creative economy study 10 years before and found quite a rich...
I would say.
Oh, it's incredible. And in fact, there's a thing called Berkshire Creative, which came out of it, which is something we're trying to replicate in some ways, that it was to promote and grow the employment base. So a number of us in the region are putting our resources together to have a creative economy seeding organization of some kind. And at the same time with our education program, we saw, wow, we need to aim this toward the reality that this is not just about good for your education and good for your well-being, but it's actually an employment opportunity for a lot more people than maybe people think.
Okay, into all of this, we're going to bring Christine Sheehan, who has been with Proctor's for 25 years.
That's correct.
You don't look it, but that's that's a long time. And what is your job? What are you supposed to do?
I'm supposed to build that audience that continues to support the arts and our industry. So, you know, bringing children into our programs and bringing them up through and establishing relationships with their families and making sure that we're providing that relevance that Philip talks about. You know, we don't want to just throw spaghetti at the wall. We want to produce and create programs that are a significant need in the region.
Now, I want to ask you both a question, if I can. You're going to call me cynical, and I'm sorry for that in advance.
I would never call you cynical.
Yeah, but
not publicly.
Right, got it. But virtually every theater company now has, Tanglewood has, everybody has an outreach program for young people, so that you are not unique in doing this. So the cynical part is my suspicions that it's not only being on the side of the gods, but also because it's demanded of you, because people will give money if you've got something going for young people.
Absolutely, people give money because of things for young people. Absolutely.
Oops.
We spend more than they give us. So our side of the gods is still our side of the gods.
Could you go a little further, Philip?
All I meant is that the cynic side of this would say that we raise money and then don't spend it on education, right?
No.
That's the cynical
That's
side.
That's not what I'm saying.
But, well, that would be the cynical side. The reality of it for us is that we raise money for education, absolutely, and we also spend money that isn't raised. We spend more than we raise in order to make it happen because we think it's a priority. So as we go and we try to invent ways to finance these things, we invented a way through BOCES to have school districts who would sign on. We'll give them the money to buy a program from us as long as they'll take what's called a COSER, Cooperative Services Agreement, rebate from the state on the same program the following year, in a sense giving the school the capacity to continue to buy and service the kids with these kinds of programs.
BOCES, for those people who are not aware of it, is sort of a regional setup where vocational...
Board of Cooperative Educational Services, established by the state in the 60s as a way for largely smaller school districts, but not totally, to collaborate affordably, and to reward that collaboration by having a refund based on a property assessment value. So when a school like Schenectady or Troy is involved with us on a COSERD Cooperative Services Agreement program, they might get 85% of the money back the following year. We just say to that district, please spend it on the same arts and education program, and they do.
So, Christine, when you try to interest schools and BOCES and people like this in your program to get the kids in. What's in the back of your mind? In other words, what is it that it becomes so imperative about getting them to cooperate?
Well, they're faced with tremendous challenges. So their inclination is not to say yes, but ours is to say yes. So we try to break down all those barriers and make it as easy as possible because we know the rewards are always there. Most of our under-resourced schools in the district have no problem making that commitment. It's more difficult to get the commitment from the suburban schools.
And why is that?
You know, they don't have the disparity that the under-resourced schools do. They're, you know, the BOCES connection is not as logical for them because they don't get a high reimbursement rate. So, you know, we try to entice them by building programs like the National High School Musical Theater Awards, and they will definitely want to participate in something like that.
Well, having grown up in New York City in nearby Scarsdale, where I once had a girlfriend and I used to come up and be treated like a poor country rat, I knew that, you know, you take rich kids or well-heeled kids and their parents are going to want to give them every kind of theatrical and musical experience that they can. So doesn't that run counter to what you were finding?
Not exactly. You know, we want to give those opportunities too. We just want to make sure that they're given equally across the board. So the kids from, you know, Niskayuna High School or Bethlehem High School will want to participate in those programs.
Those are rich schools, by the way.
Well, okay, yes. So, we'll want to participate in those activities as well, and I don't think we'll have a problem.
I think especially, my point is especially.
Especially.
Because, you know, everybody's going to be a star.
Well, the differential here is that those parents make that choice for our summer programs, which are extensive. We have a dozen summer schools, one of them including a new program this year that we have students working with professionals in every department of creating theater, from the music in the pit to the costumes to the stage work to create a show. And the show we're doing is all shook up. So for the first time, we're doing an actual performance with young people. But the young people are actually working with pros, and they're going to have a professional experience on the main stage. And suburban parents want to buy that, want to pay into that, which is fine because we have a scholarship program for the kids who can't afford it, and it's pretty extensive. But that's different than what the suburban schools do. The schools are the ones, because they don't have the larger reimbursement, who are a little hesitant to participate, but the parents are less so.
Okay, that's good. Now let me ask you both a question. What's the difference between Schenectady and Albany?
9 miles?
Just about.
Seems to me that's a lot more than 9 miles. When I go there, I think I could go to California. You know,
your car must go very slowly, the Prius. So, that's all I can think of.
Well, it's made out of plastic. So, my point is there is a culture in each area. Is the cultural imperative, if that's a good word, and maybe it's not, of Albany, where you certainly have been instrumental in helping things like the public theater and other things, but is there a different character to Albany when it comes to the arts than to Schenectady? Now, there's a good question, isn't it?
Sure, that is a good question. Actually, the characters of all four cities are really remarkably different. We have a footprint in Albany with Cap Rep, as you said. We have a footprint in Saratoga with our relationship with Universal Preservation Hall that's raising money for a restoration. And we've come to really see and learn a lot about how different they are. At the same time, Ward Dales and the theater program at Albany High is... he's doing an amazing job, and we are active working with him and bringing residency activity to his classes. That's not that different than what Bill Ziskin does in Schenectady, and with very similar blend of kids who are walking in and saying they want to participate. It's not, you know, the white kids or the middle class ones. It's all kids. And the bottom line, is the feel different at Albany High School than Schenectady High School? Absolutely. Is the ambition, desire, willingness to learn something that involves activity and art and theater in both places among all those kids? Absolutely.
Now, Philip Morris, you have no greater fan than me. But, you know, my job here is to keep it interesting. You
yes,
understand that.
Absolutely.
And so, therefore, I want to ask you, you know, a question, because you avoided the answer to the last question.
I didn't avoid. I shifted it a little bit. I had my training in media.
I understand. However, I'm asking you, let me give you a hint. I see Albany as what we could only call a Hudson River estuary. Now, an estuary, you know, the ocean comes in and then you get salt in the water and then it goes out and you get clear water. Albany, same thing. The legislature comes in, then they go out, and then they're not here anymore.
There's some brine left over, a few mussels, a few clams.
Yeah, yeah. So that's Albany. Now, I've given you that description of Albany. So what's Schenectady?
You know, Schenectady does feel more like a river town than an estuary town.
Meaning that...
You know, when I was in Western New York, I did a lot of free consulting as part of a group that did stuff along the Finger Lakes. And I came to see something about the state that I think Schenectady is the beginning of, and that's the distinction with Albany. And that was the intellectual migration from Boston west as the country grew. So here you have in the Finger Lakes, in the state of New York, all these Finger Lakes going north and south, and all the counties that
You mean if you look at the Finger Lakes on the map, you're going to see that each of those lakes goes north and
north
south.
North and south.
Okay.
And then if you look at the counties that embrace those lakes,
sure.
All of them, they're all kind of north and south. But in fact, all migration, all intellectual migration, everything that happened about the human connection to this landscape was east to west, be it the building of the towns in the northern part of the lakes, be it the roads that emerged, be it the highway that emerged, be it the trains that emerged. The state is sort of naturally wanting to go one way. Its nature wants to go one way, and humanity wants to go the other way across it. And Schenectady is the beginning of that in a way that's different than Albany, because Albany is the top of the estuary. And Schenectady is the beginning of going west. I live in a very old house, a 1701 house in Schenectady, and I walk up my driveway and take a left, and there's a historic marker that's really amazing. And it says, the beginning of Westina. And Westina is Dutch for wilderness.
Hmm.
So at some point, 1701, that house was the westernmost house. And west of that was Westina, was wilderness.
Yeah.
I think that's different than what Albany ever felt.
Okay, but we do know something about Schenectady. We know that, you know, as wonderful a place as it is, they had a huge hit, much like Pittsfield, in which the company left the town and left it sort of bereft at the time. Into this comes Philip Morris and his wonderful staff, and you have to figure out how do we take a town which has suffered this terrible hit and make it into something that is a creative economy, as you put it, into a place where people want to come. I was only half kidding when I said when I drive there, I can never quite remember how to do it, you know, from the Berkshires or from Albany. So you have to make it an attractive destination, which you have done by the kinds of things that you've put up at the theater. But you still have a town that had a terrible trauma happen to it. Do you acknowledge the trauma?
Oh, yeah, the trauma was enormous, clearly. You know, I think the shift was a shift that recognized we were part of a larger place. And it wasn't just in Schenectady. I think this is true for Troy and, frankly, Albany and Saratoga, too. What I like to call us as a region is a suburb surrounded by cities rather than a city surrounded by suburbs.
Hmm.
And if you look, if you get on your Google map and you go up, you know, a mile and a half, on the outside of those four cities, you could walk to a farm outside that. It's not a circle, it's an oblong kind of shape. But inside those four cities, you walk to suburbia. You walk to shopping, you walk to suburban style homes, you walk to what other places have on the outside of their cities. We have it on between all of our cities. And Proctor's is successful only because we understand we're one significant, not to be replicated resource for the region. And the region makes us successful. If we were a town of 65,000 in Iowa, what we do would never happen.
But into all of this comes your genius, frankly, and guts in bringing in Broadway shows, things that do not happen in other places. You have a big house. How many people does it fit?
2,600.
So it's not the biggest of all time, but it's enough to support Broadway theater presentations that come into Schenectady, and that attracts the region. Is that the theory?
Right. Right. The marketplace, if you looked at a scatter map of our marketplace, and this is true for our education program, too, without trying to just go off track. But it's true. If you look at a scatter map of who we relate to, it's not Schenectady-centric. In fact, it's a little bit east of Schenectady, somewhere between Schenectady and Albany, if you were to throw the dart that said, where's the densest
name the
place?
Towns.
It's everything. It's from the Berkshires to Potsdam down to Poughkeepsie to Utica. And again, the density, it's not like everything's in Schenectady and then radiates out. Everything's sort of the center. It's someplace in that lower end of the central suburb. Someplace around Rexford, Niskayuna, Loudonville. That's the center, and it radiates out from there. And that's true for our education program, too. Kids come from all those places.
How do you get them there? You have school buses that bring them in, or do you...
Sometimes it's school buses. Sometimes it's parents if it's the summer school program. Sometimes we arrange transportation. We go looking for grants just for transportation support for schools who are reticent to be able to fund the buses. So we'll fund the buses. And so just not to have you point at me again and say, I changed the subject. I did. But that's also true for... why Proctor's works.
Yeah.
Because it's part of a bigger region. And when we ignore that, if we were ever to ignore that, we would put ourselves at serious risk of failure.
So, Philip Morris, I have to say that Schenectady is in upstate New York. Now, we can always define upstate as anything north of Yonkers, but we don't have to. It's in real upstate New York. I've always seen Schenectady as a little pocket. And as you say, the whole idea is to reach out and make it regional. So you do that. And I'm wondering, because we have a governor who has clearly decided that upstate has to be a magnet. In other words, upstate is hurting. It's just hurting. And the governor has put a lot of attention into upstate New York. Can he turn it around? I ask you that not only as the boss of Proctor's, but as a really good mind. Is upstate dead? And is there any chance of resurrection?
I don't think upstate ever was dead. So, of course, you're asking the question to keep the entertainment going.
I am not.
I lived in Western New York for 25 years, and I watched Buffalo's worst days. And is Buffalo back? Well, certainly people will say it's back, and I think Buffalo is one of the nicest towns in the country, but it's not back yet. We have to recognize our resources. What we have are things other places in the country don't have.
But wait. The governor put $1 billion into Buffalo. This is known as the Buffalo Billions. It's gotten him into a little trouble. There's a question of how the contracts were awarded and stuff like that. Why can't he do that to Schenectady?
Look, the governor can do any kind of a development effort he wants. I actually think that the development effort around Startup New York isn't bad and isn't failing. I think it takes time because it's a complex kind of project.
Mm.
And I don't think it's the sort of thing you measure in a year or a year and a half. I think it's a point of view. And a point of view is the important thing about upstate because we have huge resources. We have intellectual resources of significance. We have natural resources of significance. And we have a relationship to the fabulous city of New York, which needs to grow. Personally, the thing I would be fighting for is a fast train from Buffalo to New York City. I think California is doing a great thing by building that connection between San Francisco and L.A. And if we built that kind of infrastructure, we might see a real shift.
You think that's analogous between L.A., you know, and San Francisco is analogous to between Buffalo and New York City?
No, they're not analogous. The cities are very different. But the need for California to be connected is high, and that governor's trying to do it. And the need for New York to be connected is high. It's part of what worked upstate, but it was from Boston West. Now we need to grow that.
So how much trouble is upstate in? I mean, you know, you have to come up with the money, the resources, the donors, the grants.
I have no way to judge that. I don't think it's in trouble. We end
Philip,
up...
you are a very smart guy. So don't tell me you have no way to...
I don't have a way. I don't think we're in trouble. I don't think upstate's in trouble. I think we always have to fight for what we have, and that's part of being alive, is fighting for what you have. You leave it alone, the grass grows up in between it, right? So we have to work and fight for what we have.
Okay. So we are talking to Christine Sheehan and Philip Morris from Proctor's. Christine, I'm going to ask you a question.
Thank you.
Do you agree with Philip that upstate is not in trouble?
Oh, don't ask me those questions, Alan. I would love to talk about our education programs, but I don't feel like Upstate's in trouble. I don't get that impression when I'm in the schools.
Talk to me about your education program.
Okay.
Get into specifics.
You know what? What do you feel in the schools? I am interested. When you're in the schools, what do you think? What do kids feel when you're in the school?
Kids are still the same kids as when I went to high school. They want opportunity. They are very enthusiastic about any opportunity that you bring to the table. They're excited. Teachers are still want to do the right things in the classroom. They have less resource than they used to, but they are not discouraged. They're not leaving their field as quickly as people expected they would. And
I mean, teachers aren't.
Teachers.
Well, a job is a job in Upstate New York.
Well, that's true. So I don't get that impression, and I spend a lot of time in Albany High School and Schenectady High School because we have two teaching artists embedded there. And
so when you go in, what do you do?
When I go into the schools, I meet with principals. I observe classrooms.
What happens when you meet with a principal?
We talk about the programming that we have. We make sure goals are being met, strategic planning for future. Do we want to continue the programs the way they are? What do we need to change? Is there enough resource available? You know, can we buy more cameras? Things like that.
Why do you need cameras?
We need cameras because kids use them. We have a MediaWorks program in three area high schools, Albany High School, Schenectady High School, and now Ballston Spa High School, that integrates English language arts with filmmaking. So kids are engaged in a non-traditional learning method, which goes back to our, you know, workforce development. We're teaching them a skill before they get out of high school.
And where does this show up? To follow up on Philip's very good question as an interviewer, is there a place for them to show off what they have accomplished with the film? I mean, you put on the boyfriend or something like that, and you know, on the stage, and people sing and dance. It's great. The parents come. Everybody's very happy with that. But film, where do they have a chance to show that off?
Film festivals. They'll show them off at their schools, obviously. But you know, some of the student work is good enough to enter into regional festivals. And especially, you know, in Ballston Spa, there's a film festival up there, and we hope that the kids will start entering their work. But those are, you know, just like we perform performances on stage, there are premieres that we offer that show student work in film and media.
Okay. We're doing one in a couple of weeks. Plus, we run the public access television for Schenectady County.
One
of the channels is an education channel, full-time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the festival winners will get broadcast over OSM, Open Stage Media, and will be available as webcasts from Open Stage Media.
Well, that's really exciting. Are you an imperialist? In other words, every time I turn around, you've taken something else over.
I thought you meant those beautiful old 60s Chrysler Imperials.
I mean,
I am an imperialist. I love those Chryslers.
Yeah, so I mean, you've done a magnificent thing in helping the public theater in Albany, and you've done similar work in the other core cities of the region. Do you always see these as opportunities, or do you want to bring everybody under your wing?
It's based on mission. You know, the mission is to support excellence in education, quality economic development, sustainable economic development, and rich civic dialogue. So those three agendas are what we measure against. And if something looks like it can either support quality education or be a sustainable example of economic development or support civic dialogue, not unlike the mission here, that we're going to do it. We're going to try to do it. We're going to try to make those things happen.
Yeah. When you see a potential basket case, in other words, people who are not doing well, and you offer to help, what is your motivation? I mean, is it to really help, which I could believe if you say so, Philip, or is it something else? Is it a thing, I'll get this too?
No, it's about helping. It's about making a difference to things that matter. You know, and sometimes we don't help. You know, not often. We usually say yes.
Oh, wait a second. Does that imply that people approach you rather than you're approaching them?
Oh, 90% of the time they approach us.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Groups, organizations come forward 90% of the time and say, can we work with you on something? Can we try to make this happen? Can we try to make that happen? I mean, the Empire State Youth Orchestra came to us with a great idea, which was to bring a Il Sistema kind of program, the program created in Venezuela for young people to have music lessons early in life, to Schenectady. And their dilemma was that they didn't quite know how to finance it. And we spent a long time working with them to talk through the BOCES arrangement, some funding opportunities to help structure something that they do. We don't make any money on it. We don't get anything out of it except knowing that 65 kids are being really well served. And they want to grow that, which is terrific. And we'll sit with them and spend hours talking about how they grow it.
So has it worked?
It worked for a year. I mean, yes. The answer is yes. They've done it for 1 year. They're doing it again in the fall, and their growth is probably a little slower than they would like. I think they're still doing 60 this year, right?
Right.
And so they're not able to grow next year yet, but they're on a path to do that.
Did you want to ask Christine a question about that?
Well, she knows everything about it. I know less.
So, Christine, you know, I went to Joan of Arc Junior High School many, many years ago on the west side of Manhattan, and they had musical instruments for every kid.
Right.
That doesn't exist anymore in most places. So this is a big problem, right? How do you get a violin into a kid's hands? How do you get a trumpet into a kid's hands?
It is a huge problem. And one of the things that we do is we work with the Tools for Schools and help get some donations of musical instruments in the hands of those kids. And we also, you know, develop after-school programs. I mean, it's classroom by classroom, but that's one of the things that we offer.
The Tools for Schools thing is interesting because once a year we solicit instruments from people's closets and we'll end up with 60, 70 instruments a year.
Yeah.
And the three or four music businesses in the region will make them playable at no cost. They'll do that pro bono, and then at least 60 kids get an instrument. It could be a horn, it could be a violin, it could be a guitar.
Do they keep them or do they?
They keep them. They're theirs.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
I mean, it's only 60. You'd need really 600. But at least it's 60 that left the closet and are used again.
Yeah. So, Christine, back to you. Do you solicit grants? Do you go for grants?
Yes.
Is that one of your jobs?
Yes. Everything that we do in education, as Philip said, is either grant-supported or through private dollars.
So tell us about a typical meeting between you and a granting organization,
with
maybe the project director, or the person who gives out the grants, or maybe the full committee. Often these organizations have some very wealthy people, the stand-up people in a community who are there, and you have to make the case for this. Tell us how you do it.
Right. Well, we're fortunate enough at Proctor's now that we have a full-time grant writer. So what I do is I meet with Justin regularly to talk about our program. So, you know, depending on the funder and, you know, what their mission is and what their priorities are, then we see if we're a good fit and what the program could be. We have a variety of programs, about 18 of them that we run, and just hit the objectives. We go through all of the grant applications and he sends them off. So if I need to be in a meeting, that's...
Well, wait. I mean, I know a little about this because we have the same situation, you know, here.
Mm-hmm.
The grant writer can certainly write a good proposal for you, but somebody's got to go in there. These granting organizations get an awful lot of material in the mail, but somebody's got to go and look them in the eye. Is that you? Is it Philip? Is it a board member that you have?
Could be a mixture. Sometimes it's all of us.
And what do they say to you? What are the usual stumbling blocks?
Well, I don't know if there's stumbling blocks. It's
there's a no and a yes.
Well,
in
usually
the case of the no's, there's a stumbling block.
We don't get too many no's, thankfully, because we have quality documentation of everything that we do. You know, we do evaluation on all of our programs, so we show them statistics. We show them, you know, our passing rates for the ninth grade media work students. We show that we can boost attendance by some of our programs. We show them success rates among programs. We show them, you know, students over periods of years as we follow them through our programs, you know, what their grades are like and those sorts of things. So we can back up what we say with some good data.
No's only come when we haven't done our homework well enough and we really missed some granting organization's agenda. We misinterpreted their agenda. And so you have a visit with somebody who says no, and you find out why. And it's usually not because we aren't doing a good job.
You find out right there at the
point. We miscommunicated the opportunity. You know, because we don't have in the capital region, there's certainly some places of good wealth. I don't mean that we don't have wealth, but we don't have the wealth of a Boston or a New York or a Chicago. It is about thousands of relationships. And you guys understand that from here. We have 3,500 individual donors. We have probably 500 sponsors and granting organizations that we have a relationship with. Again, probably not unlike AMC. And that is an intense amount of work. it's just an intense amount of work because there's no $1 million falling from the sky for you guys and for us.
No, that's
just
right.
Not happening. And we don't expect it to happen. So instead, it's about those excellent relationships and making sure what we promise we deliver.
Yes, but where there is money in Schenectady.
Well, the capital region,
the capital region, where there is money, obviously your work is known and held up. Does your board help you at all?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The board's 35 people. They're from throughout the region, from Lake George to Albany and Troy and Schenectady. And, in fact, there's only two people from Schenectady on the board.
What does that tell you?
That we're a regional organization, that we tried hard to reflect that at the governance level.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
And they're very helpful opening doors. You know, there'll be a phone call that says, you know what, I just learned that this person has this interest, and that's all we need to hear.
Yeah. Is there something to be said about, frankly, well-heeled or rich people speaking to other people who are well-heeled?
Well, like anything, it's relationships. So if you know David better than I do, and David Gustina is prepared to be supportive of something really significant in the community, it would be helpful for you to walk in that door with me and talk to David, rather than me go to David only knowing him a little bit.
So how can you extrapolate that for everybody else who's listening right now, all four of them, who will tell you what they should do to get money? Educate us as to what all of us should be doing to do better in this area, because you've been very successful.
The rules are kind of straightforward for everybody, right? Deliver what you promise. Be honorable.
Find that there are dishonorable people in the profession?
Sure.
Can you name a few?
Absolutely not. But they're clear. We know who they are, and we won't work with them. You know, if people or organizations that have stiffed other people or organizations are just, that's not honorable. You just can't proceed like that.
Right.
Even though you might be able to hide it for a little while, eventually it comes out.
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of yours, as you probably know, or don't, but I am. And one of the things I respect about you so much is the ability to say a single word, which is no. No is not an easy thing for any of us who run major organizations. If you're running a radio station and people, or a series of 29 radio stations, people know how valuable it is, they'll come and they'll say, My daughter-in-law wrote a novel, self-published it, it's the best thing that ever was, and some of these people could be potential donors. Now you have to say no. You do have to say no.
Yeah.
How do you raise the gumption to do that?
Philip never says no.
Philip does say no.
No, he sends it on.
Oh, well, I do that too. But it's still a no.
He sends it to one of us.
Of course.
And he tells us not to say no.
Well, we like to be in a position where we say yes. And that's largely because of kids, because many kids don't hear yes all the time. Many schools don't hear yes all the time. So we like to say yes. My joke is just say yes. But your example is something a little different, which is someone's assumption of what the quality of what they have and its potential impact on the planet.
Do they believe it?
And they often believe it. And sometimes you do have to say no. I mean, there was a lovely lady who wanted to create an art center in Schenectady, and she simply had the right intention and she didn't have the capacity to do it. And we weren't going to do that for her, which is kind of what she was asking. And so it was, good luck. Here's some places to go. We'll always give you advice, always. We'll do the best advice we can give. But then you've got to move forward yourself.
But, you know, Mr. Murr, don't you know I want you to put on my daughter-in-law's play? And I'll tell you what, if you do that, I'm going to give you $100,000.
Yeah, well, you know, Alan, I'm going to give you $1 million to interview my son and make sure that he gets 150 musical gigs this coming year. What do you think? It's a balancing act, right?
Well, no, it is a balancing act, and I say no all the time, and I've made a few people who are unhappy with me along the way because of what you said before. They really believe that the son-in-law or the daughter-in-law does have a great book, but you've looked at it. It's terrible. And, of course, what Christine said is exactly right. I often send on to our wonderful producer, David Gustina, I said, and I try to give them a hint. I say, well, you know, that this isn't something we usually do, but I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to send it on to David Gustina. And David, poor David. Yeah, no, and there's a general rule, which is, I'm going to tell you the truth. If I say I'm going to send it on, there is obviously the knowledge on the part of the recipient of your message that you're sending it on, and some of them will say, thank you for doing that. And then, of course, there's always the receptor, the David Gustinas or the Joe Donahue's or the others, who have to know what I really want.
You know, part of this question comes down to something that anybody who's taken art class, our kids all in our schools witness, which is honest interaction. And if you've taken a painting class and go through the critique, the crit, your painting is put up on the wall, your one-minute choreography is in front of 50 other kids, and then the teacher and the kids rip it apart. And they have to rip it apart in a way that's reflective of someone's feelings, but still be honest. And if you come off as a jerk and just sort of go, that was the worst damn thing I've ever seen, you're a loser, oh, excuse me, then of course there's no credibility to that, and people leave mad. If you say, I've read this, I've read it thoroughly, and I really don't think it has a place here, and here are the reasons, someone might leave angry, but you didn't treat them badly. Mm. And that's part of what, you know, again, a kid learns by doing things in the arts that they put up in front of others, and adults need to learn, and all of us need to, the better we are at that, you and I, as well as young people who are learning it, the better we are at being able to communicate without anger. So, and I think that's critical.
So ask Christine a question now. Remember in the beginning of the show, we were talking and I was giving you more attention than I was giving her because you brought her with you to talk about the education program. And you did a great job as an interviewer. So I was wondering, do you have another question for her?
Absolutely.
Oh, good.
Have you witnessed our stuff in critique? How can you talk about the stuff we do and that notion of honest evaluation?
Well, you know, part of what we do is to be educators first, and that's from whether we're hiring teaching artists or we are dealing with interns in our theater, is that we all need to find proactive ways to give feedback on our programming, on an individual lesson, on a masterclass, on a relationship with a funder, on a relationship with a teaching artist, and that's why we can be successful in all of our.
So give a quick
areas.
Example. Give an example of something you witnessed like that, that you were really proud of. You walked away and went, boy, that was handled beautifully.
Recently, we had some teaching artists interacting with students, and one of our faculty didn't feel it was going well, and she threw herself in there and taught the kids and the teaching artists at the same time a better way to handle the situation. It's a very vague response, I know.
It's a great answer because I've seen that happen. So then the question then becomes, what happens if, you know, you get somebody who embarrasses you? I mean, it happens. Somebody says something that is politically incorrect or socially incorrect, and how do you jump in there? Is it on you, as my kids used to say, it's right. On you, Dad. Right. Is it on you to make the correction?
Well, it's a life skill. It's, you know, it's certainly in the summer programs, especially. I had a director challenge me right in front of all of the students because I was addressing something that we needed to fix with them. And he cut me off and said, you know, we're getting to the show. We have to get to the show. We have to get to the show. This is what we're going to do. And I stopped instead of escalating it and told the kids, you know, the director and the education director aren't always going to agree. Mm-hmm. And I said, but we both have your best interests at heart. We want you to perform the best way, and my responsibility to you is to make sure the experience is a good one. So we're both going to do that going forward.
I want to remind everybody that we're listening to my friend Philip Morris, CEO of Proctor's Theater, and Christine Sheehan, Director of Education Programs for Proctor's. You guys have been together for a long time now, right?
Actually, at the top of the interview, I was going to say this. When I arrived in 2002... Chris was working not full-time, I think 4 days a week or 3 days a week, doing special events.
Right.
And I had a really cruddy chair that had one of those bottom busters, you know, that had things popping up from the bottom.
Oh, and, not the chair of your board, the chair of your set.
Yeah, sorry, the chair of my desk. Yes. And Chris saw me wiggling around it, and she goes, you know what? I'll take care of that. I'll get another chair for you. And I'm like, really? And she did. And then I found that she was just always able to get something done. She would just, if the goal line was there, she knew how to get to the goal line. I often say it's the skill of a stage manager. Kids who become stage managers are the best project people because they are told at the beginning, here are your resources, and here's the goal line. And the two come together always on time because the curtain opens at 8. Just every day, opens at 8, so you better be there and better be ready. And when I decided that we had to have a more expanded education program, and Chris had been doing the programming that was in the proctors that had kids bust in, and I looked at her and said, do you want to have an adventure and take this on? I don't know where it's going to go, but it's going to be a big thing. And she looked at me and she said, I would love to do that. I'm right. I don't remember exactly, but
That's pretty much what happened, yes.
And I said, okay.
But when you went to college, did you major in education?
I majored in music education.
Music education.
I did have the background.
Pretty well prepared.
Yeah.
Do you have the ability to say no to him? I mean, what if he comes up with a crappy idea? David Gustina, my producer, does it almost every day.
Then we talk quietly among my staff, and we figure out a way that we can convince Philip it was his idea to go a different way. That's what he does to us.
That's great. That's great.
Chris will come up to me all the time. They'll go, no, you're not going to make us do that.
I'm not afraid to tell Philip no. He drives me crazy.
Philip, the next question, of course, is somewhat sensitive, but I'm going to go there anyway. I love the way you look. I mean, you know, you're a big fellow, you have a beard, you always have, you know, you have a ponytail, you are expected to, and I do love that, but you're expected to deal with the people who really have the money and have made it in business and the rest of it. Do your looks help you or hurt you with people?
I have no way to measure that except
to
say...
Well, intuitively, you're an intuitive guy.
Well, except to say that I don't ever feel people... walking away from me because of my looks.
It may make you more accessible, as a matter of fact.
Maybe. You know, this is work. And
what
the arts are work.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't dress up except as necessary. And certainly I know when to dress up, and I will. But I don't dress up on a day-to-day basis because...
Why not? I do. I think it's important for the head of an organization to always wear a necktie.
Yeah, well, that's important to you. I get that. And that particular necktie is absolutely spectacular with apples. One green apple. No, two green apples. But I see it as we're in a workplace. It needs to be comfortable. We need to be able to work. And that there's a statement about it being work that's different than when a costume's required.
There's something going on, which is very interesting, and that has to do with tax credits. But before everybody shuts their eyes, tell us what it is.
Bunch of us theater operators from upstate that do Broadway went to the legislature and the governor to seek an upstate theater tax credit. And the credit would be for producers of Broadway shows who were building touring versions that if they opened and teched, meaning assembled, rehearsed, pulled together those shows upstate, they'd get a credit, 25% credit.
What does that mean? I'm sorry, because there may be people out there who don't know what a tax credit is.
What it means is that the investors would receive 25% of a credit against their taxes, if they had New York State taxes, for having the show open upstate New York. So it's a way to indirectly support Broadway upstate.
So are there takers?
There are a lot. This year, first full year, there are 5 shows opening upstate. They're opening from Buffalo to Schenectady. And in Schenectady, we're opening an American in Paris, which won many Tonys last year, and the show will open in October. And what's very exciting, in fact, we have 2 shows opening this year, American in Paris and Something Rotten, which is still playing in New York, too, also a really fun, great show. But what we have built and what Chris Sheehan, our education director, has built is a boot camp for high school students who will one day a week for the 4 weeks of the tech and the 1 week of the show run will have a full day of the opportunity to witness, talk to the designers, talk to the creative team that's there assembling the costumes, building the set, creating and rehearsing the show before it goes on tour. And they'll have teaching opportunities and classes outside of the theater and inside the theater, being able to witness these shows being built. It's kind of never been done before. And we're ecstatic because no high school kid will ever have had an experience like this, anywhere else.
Now, Philip Morris, this credit is for New York State taxes, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So the legislature had to say it and the governor had to approve it. Is that right?
Yep. That's exactly.
Okay. And now when you are trying to get these terrific touring shows, because in each case, these are not before they go to Broadway. They're after they're on Broadway. And now they're going to set up a national tour.
Right.
And you want to be the showcase for that when they come. Now, do you have to get involved in that negotiation?
Oh, yeah. Every time.
How do you do it?
Well, by knowing the producers, by being friends and talking regularly. It's a relationship business. It's a small pool of producers, a small pool of agents, and we all kind of know each other. In some ways, we're competitive with a Buffalo or a Rochester. In other ways, we're not at all. We're trying to do the best thing by each other. So the show Neverland is going to open and begin its tour in Tech in Buffalo, which is great because Harvey Weinstein was one of the biggest producers. Harvey has this long relationship with Buffalo when he was the rock and roll producer, Harvey and Corky. Harvey wanted to do the show in Buffalo, which is terrific. So that show ends up getting the credit and opening upstate. My hope someday is that we'll have 5 shows opening upstate in the same week, and we can actually promote coming to New York's upstate Broadway.
What gets you angry?
Not a lot, actually. I don't get angry very often. I suppose I get
anything I've said today that made you angry?
You can't make me angry. It's not possible. I suppose the thing that makes me most frustrated, and probably you too, is personnel dilemmas.
Yeah.
You know, you sit there and go, how on earth could that have happened? My God, what could somebody be thinking that would happen?
Yeah.
And that's the stuff that sort of makes you go home and want to drink. Wow, jeez. But
true.
Other than that,
it's true.
Nothing makes me angry.
Following through on that question, have you ever had to fire anybody?
Oh, sure.
And how's that go? I mean, to me, that's the hardest part of this job, having to fire. We don't do it very often, but when we do it, generally it's that somebody has created a situation where they really have to go.
Well, all of the managers at Proctor's have been in that position. Chris has been in that position. I've been in that position. There's just, you know, there aren't many options. You have to make a leap, and, you know, you and I both fired the same person, so.
I told you not to do that.
and so it's part of making the organization work. And part of that often isn't just the ability of a person, but the ability of someone to get along and fit into a culture of an organization. We try to be a culture where that's collaborative, and we work very hard at it. And if somebody needs help stuffing envelopes, 10 of us will go stuff envelopes for an hour. When that goes away, I'm not sure the organization does well. When we have a big on sale for tickets, every single person upstairs is selling tickets.
What about volunteers? Now, volunteers are interesting because you don't pay them, and yet every once in a while, a volunteer will screw up badly.
Yep, and they have to be fired sometimes.
You have to fire your volunteers sometimes.
Yeah, we have 1,200, and we've been in the position
to fire
volunteers.
And what do they do?
Volunteers.
They're in the
bartenders,
theater.
They're ushers. They deal with our concessions and our sales on our little stores. They support stuffing things. They're volunteers for the education program in the summer now. They're welcoming people and registering people, and if they mess up, you forgive them, but if they mess up consistently or really blatantly say, I'm not doing that, we can't proceed in that kind of environment.
And Christine, have you ever been in that situation where, you know, you have to, you know, be the bad guy?
Yes.
What do you do? Do you have a philosophy? What do you bring them in the room? Do you say you're fired, Donald Trump style, or what do you do?
I think you have to be sensitive to people. People are all human, and you have to treat them like a person when they come in. What if they cry? I've seen crying, but, you know, you have to just maintain, we have to protect our integrity, and, you know, especially working with youth, we have to be very careful about, you know, our procedures in place, so you follow the lines, and you are careful on your documentation, and, you know, we don't want to fire anybody, we don't want to let anyone go in our organization, but there are things that, you know, we have to preserve the mothership, ultimately.
Well, I've always thought, Philip and Christine, I've always thought the following thing, which is, be very careful when you hire somebody, because at some point it'll be far worse if you have to fire them. Am I right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's very true.
Especially with students in the education program. Christine, we need to do fingerprinting, and we need to do all of that kind of testing, because they're with kids, and there's no way you can make a mistake like that and survive it.
And yet, when you do fingerprinting, there's going to be somebody from one civil liberties group or another who are going to say, that's not right.
No, it's yet to happen, and I think in regards to being with kids, there's not much choice. It's just a necessity.
Because kids are so vulnerable, especially in these days when bad things happen.
When bad things happen.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. And I think parents would expect no less.
Have you seen it?
We've not. We've been very fortunate. We've not seen any kind of problems like that.
Right. But
we work very hard at it.
How so?
At the interview and review process.
You mean of your staff?
Yeah, we're very, very careful, especially, again, on the dealing with student side, you know, in contact with student side.
Well,
at the same time, you know, Alan, I want to say, Chris isn't the only 25-year employee. We have a lot of people who have been there a long time.
Yeah, I get that.
We have a couple backstage guys been there 30 years. We have all of the senior staff. Except one has been there extensively. I mean, 10 years, 20 years. It's kind of amazing and wonderful. And it's wonderful to see someone retire from us. Holy, you know, that's like amazing. But we've had a number of retirements recently, and wow, cool, terrific.
We've been in conversation today with my friend Philip Morris, CEO of Proctors Theater, and Christine Sheehan, Director of Education Programs for Proctors. Philip, Christine, thanks so much for joining us today. Very much appreciated.
Our pleasure. Thank you, Alan.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.